Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is about This Little Red Thing, the latest anthology from Sweatshop, the Western Sydney Writers Collective. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. We record on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I want to acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ongoing connection to the land. Their stories are the original stories, and I pay my respects to them. Final Draft explores the best of Australia's books, writing, and literary culture as featured on 2SER. Now, the Great Conversations podcast is your chance to hear more of these discussions. Now, joining me to discuss This Little Red Thing are two of the book's editors, Winnie Dunn and Stephen Pham. Winnie is a Tongan Australian writer from Mount Druid, as well as the general manager of Sweatshop. And Stephen is a Vietnamese Australian writer from Campbelltown. He's also a member of Sweatshop, and his essays and fiction have appeared in The Lifted Brow, as well as Overland and Mianjin. This Little Red Thing is a collection of short works of fiction, microfiction, and poetry. It brings together nearly 50 authors and incorporates a range of ideas, perspectives, and vignettes of life in Western Sydney and across the world. Join me as we discover This Little Red Thing. My name is Andrew Popel, and we've got a really special panel about to happen. There is a fantastic new publication from Sweatshop, the Western Sydney Writers Collective. If you're any sort of listener to Final Draft, you will have met someone from Sweatshop already. And we're going to be talking today about This Little Red Thing. Joining me to discuss it are book editors Winnie Dunn and Stephen Pham. Now, you have heard from Winnie on Final Draft as recently as when she was in discussing the Boundless Festival. Winnie is a Tongan Australian writer from Mount Druitt. She's the general manager of Sweatshop, and she's one of the editors on This Little Red Thing. Welcome, Winnie. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It is great to have you here. Now, we're also joined by Stephen Pham. Stephen is a Vietnamese Australian writer from Cabramatta. He's also a member of Sweatshop. His essays and fiction have appeared in places like The Lifted Brow, Griffith Review, and Mianjin. And Stephen's also got a book deal, and his debut, Vietnamatta, will be coming out sometime in the 2020s.
Stephen, sometime in the 2020s, maybe, yeah.
Something to look forward to. I was reading some pieces that have already come out online in different publications, and I think it's something to look forward to already.
I hope so.
But enough about that. We've got to talk about This Little Red Thing. Now, This Little Red Thing is a collection of short works of fiction, microfiction, and poetry. It brings together nearly 50 authors and incorporates a range of ideas, perspectives, and vignettes of life in Western Sydney and across the world. I was hoping we could start with the inception of the project. How did it all come about? What was the idea behind This Little Red Thing?
I think the idea is that Sweatshop had numerous publications that were quite large, so that were full of either poetry or very long pieces of prose. And so that's from the conception of the Bleak Vaccine chapter 1 and 2, and then Sweatshop Women. And so the idea of kind of This Little Red Thing is that we wanted kind of short, punchy pieces from our writers in our collective, but also kind of young writers from the area who English might not be their first language. And so we wanted to kind of test the boundaries of their writing skills by kind of getting them to write like a 3-sentence story, and to really focus on what a story is, what images pop up in a story, and have them really concentrated. And so I think the kind of punchiness and the colours that come out of This Little Red Thing are really exciting.
Yeah, we discussed this off air, and it's this incredibly accomplished piece that I didn't really realize had so many high school contributors until I carefully went through the thank yous and saw that some of them were directed at high school teachers and the like. It's an amazing group of work. What were your first thoughts when these works were emerging, Steve? What did you think when you started reading these works?
Sure. I guess, for context, me and Winnie held these workshops with in high schools across Western Sydney, Lanier Intensive English Center, and also Sir Joseph Banks High School is what I did with Winnie. And so we were there for the sort of conception of these sort of works. And I guess for me, it was just fun. It was really fun to just like come in every week, have a new sort of stimulus instead of working on an extended piece, and just come in and just like talk and then sort of like write pieces that were developed from those conversations. And then just to repeat that every week for about 5 weeks?
Yeah, 5 to 10 weeks.
Yeah, five to 10 weeks.
I think, you know, kind of working with the high school kids, you know, and this is not the teacher's fault. It's just kind of the constraints of kind of our education system is that teachers just kind of have to teach them what's on the syllabus. And so that often means that they have to kind of write from a refugee perspective, or they have to kind of write a story about a book that they read, which is often by kind of this old dead white guy like Shakespeare, right? And so to come in and work with these kids and tell them that they can write their own story and tell them that they can practically write what they did yesterday down the road at the shops is really empowering for them, because they get to use their own voice to tell a narrative that isn't printed in Australian literature.
Yeah, how did the kids respond? What was their sort of immediate reaction when you said you can write in your voice, you can write what you want?
I guess for me it was... okay, so like it wasn't just us going in and being like, hey, believe in yourself. You too can be a writer. It was... For me, like my workshops, for example, I had a group of students at Lanier, and I came in, I prepared some sort of notes and stimulus, just in terms of like thinking about like a theme or like an idea or a metaphor and unpacking that with the children. For example, there are some stories that like mentioned chicken, because I came in and I was like, what do a lot of people like or have thoughts on? And I thought maybe chicken. So at home I prepared, you know, a sort of like brainstorm of like what could chicken mean metaphorically, as in like, you know, the bird, or if you wanted to talk about like other birds, that's fine too. And, you know, like KFC, you know, like chicken that you can eat, or like the idea of like cowardice, things like that. And so I discussed that with the children, with the high school students, sorry. And, you know, like, one particular story is, like, by Lazar Tadic. It's called This Thing. And do you mind if I read it out?
Oh, please, yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's cool. Absolutely fine.
And it goes, I was in the Anytime Fitness in Campbelltown, walking through the door. Then I saw a camera focusing on me. I quickly took off my shirt and started flexing around and saying, muscle, muscle, muscle. The chicken guy joined me and start dancing. And like, while we were sort of working through that, it was so clear that he just wanted to be silly and funny, and that the students around him really appreciated that. Like, they were just like, they were just having fun. And I was encouraging that, because it's just like, I really think that for me, it was not about empowering necessarily, but it's about like, literature doesn't have to be this high and mighty thing. It doesn't have to be this struggle. It can just be, I think it should be silly. I think it should be a circus. I think it should be incorporated in our everyday lives, because we always tell stories and things like that. Like, you know, like at lunchtime to entertain, to like make sense of things. And I think that I really believe in that sort of like radical, like democratization of capital L literature. And I think the students respond really well to that.
Yeah. That was a really great example that you read for us there, Stephen. But I thought, can we take a second just to unpack for some of the listeners what microfiction is? How does it work? What sort of stories does it work for? How do you guys use it in your own writing?
So microfiction is a form that's often about kind of... it kind of sits in the genre of kind of like flash fiction or vignette style, where you focus on a certain image and then you build upon that image to make a story. And so often when we're working, even with writers in our own collective, we often ask them, what is a story? And some people kind of struggle with that question, because they think of a story, like Stephen said, as this kind of high and mighty, elusive thing where, you know, I often get responses, they're like, oh, it's a conversation and something happens. And I'm like, no, but what is the technical structure of a story? And people often get stumped. And so when I tell them that it's simply just a beginning, a middle, and an end, they're often like, oh, yeah, like I learned that in kindergarten. But it's about kind of building the writer's basics. And so microfiction is really, and vignettes and flash fiction is really good for that, because often you can write a story in three sentences. Like the first sentence is the beginning, the middle sentence is the middle, and the third sentence is the end. And it's quite easy for high school students to grasp, because they're often confused as well about what a story is. And they often don't know what voice to use and how to speak about themselves. And so to be able to just give them a simple task of being like, write three sentences, write about what you did yesterday, and then we'll move on from there. And so that genre is of microfiction is building upon an image, like Stephen said about the chicken, and making it into a story.
Can I really, like, can I just add on to that and be like, for us, it's also like about being pragmatic about what writing is, being practical about it and not being romantic about it. Just having a very, like, this is exactly what it is. Like, there's nothing more to it than that. I mean, there is more to it than that, like literary techniques and like imagery and all of that. But like, just boiling it down to its very essence in a way that is actionable. That is like, literally write three sentences. One is the start, one is the middle, and one is the end. That's it. You don't have to do anything else. That's it. Like, you already know how to do this. You do it every day, but just do it intentionally. And that's like, I guess, a way of reframing how these romantic notions of literature as like, you know, about the moon and the stars and like looking in the nebulas or whatever. Like, that's, I don't know. I feel like there's this romanticization almost makes literature seem like inaccessible, as if it was like innate to certain people over others or whatever. And it's like, no, that's just like, you know, colonialism, white supremacy, patriarchy, etc.
Yeah, that's a power flex, right? That's like, so that's a group of people who feel they have ownership, wanting to take and control that ownership. And yeah, I like the pragmatism that you just brought in there, Stephen, because I was reading and I was inspired. I thought, I have this idea, an image, as you mentioned, Winnie, that I wanted to reflect. And I realized that it only involved 6 or 7 sentences, and I would have probably overthought it any other week, but because I was reading this little red thing, I thought, you know what, I'm just gonna bash that out on my phone. And even if I never think about it again, that image is still very real for me because I took the time rather than overthinking the million and one ways it could be teased out. I noticed in quite a few of the stories, the authors share distinct reminiscences that create this sort of juxtaposition between their Australian, their Western Sydney lives, and the life that the individual author had lived somewhere else in the world. Maybe it was a home country, maybe it was a country that they were moving through. Can you talk to me about what this little red thing shows us about the reality of identity in Australia today? And especially, I guess, those ideas of trying to reconcile a dual identity or get used to Australia, which, I mean, especially if you look at media representations, has a very confused identity that wants to be very white but very obviously isn't.
Well, I can speak from kind of my own dual identities, like as a mixed race kind of Tongan Australian woman. You know, both of my parents are mixed race, and so people often assume that I have one white parent and one Tongan parent, but I feel like identities are really complex, and in the Australian reality, identities are really complex and nuanced, and people have multiple identities working at one time. You know, for example, I worked at my old high school. So I went to Richard Johnson Anglican School, which is like a Anglican private school that's just up the road. Like, it's not like Sydney Girls private or something, but it's a private school in the sense that just this kind of little community in kind of Plumpton didn't want to go to Plumpton High School. So my parents thought the best thing to do was to put me into the private school, which they worked really hard to do. But at Richard Johnson, and even now, especially having worked with the kids there, there's a lot of Polynesian kids who often either grew up in their homelands and kind of moved to Australia really young, or was kind of born and raised in Australia their whole lives, but their families are so kind of Polynesian that they often feel like they're kind of either like Polynesian first and Australian second, because they feel like the Polynesian culture is what drives them the most. And, you know, an African American feminist, you know, we talked about this last time, scholar and social activist kind of bell hooks talks about that concept of mirroring, of being able to see yourself reflected in a figure. And, you know, she uses kind of Barack Obama as the example of kind of a mirroring situation where African Americans got to see themselves in the president. And so when I rocked up into Richard Johnson, my old high school, and got to work with these kind of Pacifica kids, you know, they saw me as, you know, Pacifica too. And the first thing that kind of came to their mind when I asked them to write their story was, oh, nobody's interested. Like, who wants to read that? Like, are you serious? And that's the response we, like, I usually get, especially when I'm working with writers from my own community. And so to be able to kind of sit them down and get them to write their own story is always really special to me. You know, I don't know how much of it is empowering kind of nationally, because, you know, you had Michael McCormack this year kind of say that Pacifica people are fruit pickers and that's all that we'll ever be. And when kind of our islands sink in the ocean due to climate change, we'll just come to Australia and pick fruit. And that's kind of how wider Australia sees us. But in that little moment of sitting there with the kids, with the Polynesian kids, and kind of working through their story and having it printed is really special.
I want to take us just a little bit away from the collection, but I think it's really relevant at the moment. So it's come out in the last few days. The government, in their wisdom, have decided to streamline their bureaucracy. Amongst other things, this means they're going to be ditching the Federal Arts Department, merging it with transport and communication. And I'm going to wear this joke out, but I, you know, I'm all for reading a book on a train, but otherwise I just cannot see how those two, I've already worn that joke out. It strikes me that whilst I think this is undoubtedly a regressive move that we can agree on, it's also going to have the possibility or the reality of disproportionately impacting marginalized communities who aren't represented as often in the mainstream culture. And if they do see themselves represented, they might see a very narrow representation. When you've just given us one of those representations, do you have any thoughts, or maybe how many thoughts do you have on this move and what its impact is going to be?
I'll have to actually think about this for a moment.
That's absolutely okay, yeah.
I think the way that I can talk about that kind of very kind of regressive, I would say kind of fascist move, is essentially through kind of 1-4. So 1-4 is like this all Pacific kind of drill rap crew from Mount Druitt in the area that I grew up in. And their kind of national Australia tour has been cancelled multiple times due to kind of some of the band members kind of jail time and sentencing and kind of links to like criminal activity. And I say that in a quote unquote kind of thing because so many Pacifica people struggle to move away, like I said, from the identity that's placed on them as either criminals or thugs or footballers or security guards. So 1-4's national tour has been cancelled in Australia multiple times. They're in New Zealand currently and only kind of two members can be there because the others are restricted in their travelling. But Australia also said on record that kind of right-wing white supremacist movements that kind of meet up at the beach and have politicians meet up with them on the beach can't be stopped. Can't be stopped. Like, we're just going to let it happen and let it unfold and we can't do anything about it. But they can systemically stop a lot of marginalized people from telling their own story, and that's kind of what 1-4 is. They're kind of a rap group that tell their own story and have kind of millions of listeners every week. But for some reason, they can be stopped and they can be pushed to the side, but kind of right-wing white supremacist groups can have the whole floor to do what they want. And, you know, that's what happens when you vote Liberal.
I guess, like, as far as, like, defunding the arts goes, it's kind of, I guess it's kind of scary to think that, like, they're getting rid of sort of federal funding for the arts will mean that we're going to trust institutions, like sort of maybe private institutions, to make up for that funding and to funnel their money towards causes they believe in. And because most of the institutions of Australia, which is itself, you know, a colonialist, white supremacist, patriarchal, capitalist sort of institution, like it just doesn't seem that promising to, you know, believe in the free market and the invisible hand of, like, you know, like, it just seems like, I mean, it's obviously a very deliberate move to remove, well, maybe to make it more difficult for marginalized communities to access, you know, resources that are related to critical thinking and sort of resources that allow them to empower themselves or, like, help them, aid them in empowering themselves and stuff. So, like, Yeah, it's scary, but you know, and it's pretty like messed up, but I don't know. Like, even if one, like for in the example of 1/4, even if they don't tour, even if they are prevented by, you know, the law from like touring and entering New Zealand and like doing whatever, like their rise to prominence has been through the internet, you know, mm-hmm. and there's like a decentralization that means that we can reach, we can link up with other communities without going through sort of like governments or even like a physical landscape. It's just, I don't know. I really don't know what it means. Mm. I know it's bad, but mm. I think that people who really want to tell their story or just can, or who do feel empowered to like tell their story will find a way to do it. And they always have been doing that.
I thought 1/4 was a really interesting example, and I wanted to come to them, so thank you for bringing them up. But I mean, as much as I know about them, they've been very independent in their rise, and I would be very surprised if they'd had any sort of outside government arts body funding. So they're a really interesting example, as you're saying, Stephen, of what happens outside of a bureaucratic structure. I was also just really... just the idea that we now have no body to, you know, verbalize a direction artistically and culturally for this country. And I mean, like, you look at the government in power and you wonder if you want them articulating that artistic vision, but we just don't. The arts has been folded into communication and transport. Like, somehow art is just another commodity that you either put on a train or gets transported via infrastructure. Everything's infrastructure, and we're all just building to an infrastructure future, as opposed to art being something fundamental to who we are.
Hmm. Mm. I mean, like, as much as, like, Sweatshop, at the end of the day, is about not just empowering in some sort of romantic notion of the, in some romantic sense of the word, like empowering, you know, people from marginalized backgrounds to sort of like navigate day-to-day life where really high cultural literacy is like required to avoid the sort of traps of like, you know, white supremacy and patriarchy and all that. Like, but in a very literal sense, we are about creating pathways for younger writers or people who don't even think of themselves as writers from Western Sydney communities to actually see writing as a viable option, and for us providing like sort of like opportunities to further develop that career. And you know, Winnie's like lightning fast ascension in the writing world is like the perfect example of that. But at the same time, you know, like, and like the sort of funding changes will definitely impact how we can carry that out. But I like, it's my personal belief that like, yeah, art is fundamental to who mm. we are, and like art doesn't, like, just because you write doesn't mean you have to be an author mm. just because you draw doesn't mean you have to be a, you know, an illustrator, like, and just because you sing doesn't mean like you're a singer. Like, personally, like, I sing in the shower because I just like singing in the shower. I don't want to make that a career choice. I don't want to like think about like, oh, how do I get on Spotify, how do we get streams. It's like, I'm just singing because, like, it's just something that I do. It's just an involuntary, like, reflex. Like, art is how a lot of us just process stuff and, like, express ourselves. Mm. It doesn't have to go much further than that. So, like, I don't know, like...
If we take away from that on a national level, we narrow the scope for people to actually think about art as a thing that is done.
Yeah.
Another great thing, like, the thing that I saw in this little red thing that I wanted to come to on that is the way... the book reflects and highlights the role of language in Australian society, which is so important about how we realise who we are. And especially in literature, where I think what we're taught at school is there is a writing way and a writing voice. But in the book, you know, predominantly the authors are writing in English, but the book also contains other languages spoken in Australia. There's slang, there's dialect, and then there's just sort of these casual uses of language that really stretch any definition. These are the voices that you hear on the streets of Australia, you know, to different extents, depending on where you live. But we're not often hearing them as we read through our dominant, media or our culture. These are not the voices that are, even being reflected in the background, say, necessarily of a drama as someone walks by. What does that mean, having these voices out there in this little red thing?
I think it means an alternative to a kind of very racist country, I would say, where the kind of dominant language that we hear is kind of very English or very kind of outback Australian slang, kind of colonial English.
We're very proud on certain levels of having only one way of talking, and even from a neurological development perspective, having more than one language is just like you're a superhuman compared to a monolingual person.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing about kind of Sweatshop's publications is always about reflecting the reality of Australia. You know, it's a reality that people say hectic, which is kind of the opening line of this little red thing. It's a Australian reality that people say gronks and meth heads and dickheads and sluts, which is the ending of this little red thing. And that's kind of the purpose of kind of Sweatshop's publication, is showing that Australian reality that's very much ignored and pushed to the side in terms of kind of like when you see Neighbours, when you see Home and Away, when you see kind of who's our representation in Parliament. Mm-hmm. Like that's Sweatshop's alternative to all of that, is our publications, is that publication of Australia's reality.
I think also like, maybe like tangentially related, is this idea of like coming to voice. And I guess like writers and emerging writers, obsess over this idea of like, how do I find my voice? How did you find your voice? How can you help me find my voice? And it's like, you already have one. You're using it to talk to me right now. Like on a very literal level, like the writing that we show that is in this little red thing is this process of unlearning what, this romanticized notion of a writing voice is, and getting students to literally write the voice that they use to navigate their day-to-day lives. Like this thing by Petra Pappas, one of the pieces, it isn't just like standard English. It's also like Western Sydney slang, like, talking about like fresh fades and bum bags and sort of like TNs and like all these sorts of images of like Western Sydney. But then there's also ideas, like there's also words like HKs, which for me is like Asian in Western Sydney slang. And then there's a term that he uses at the end, cum dumpster, which is from the internet, from white supremacists, misogynists on the internet, specifically 4chan. Like, and so it's this rich, it's a mix. It's just a mix. It's just like, it's all these worlds like colliding, but not actually colliding. It's just like, we are the products of like different worlds, and our voices are the products of that. Like, and we use those every day, and we're just like sort of like capturing how amazing, not amazing, but just how normal that actually is.
And it's, that's probably the most troubling thing, is that this to be exceptional in presenting something that is normal.
Yeah.
That's where you know there's a problem, if you have to exceptionalize something that is normal, something that people should be paying attention to in their everyday life. I guess one final topic that I wanted to draw us to in this conversation was about what is depicted. These are everyday reflections of high school kids and others about what happens in their life. And so there's violence in this little red thing. And this, it also seems to be like we struggle to deal with violence in Australia. We have this tendency, we're either going to other the perpetrators and make them something that can be demonized and put away, or we justify and valorize their actions because they're people that we want to keep touch with. And I mean, I've said that in slightly more academic language, and I could have just said, people of colour, marginalised communities will be put away, and if you're white, your violence is going to be justified because, you're part of the background. And the story of 1-4 has been a really interesting example of that. They've had their tour shut down by this idea that there's going to be violence at the gigs. They've never had violence at their gigs, but they deal with violence, and they particularly highlight the idea that violence happens in areas where the same privilege and opportunities are not afforded equally. What role does art and storytelling have in actually focusing in and depicting these things that we like to pretend don't happen, but we all understand do? Things like violence.
Well, I think it's really important to understand that, first of all, that what 1/4 does as people of color is they're telling stories, right? And they're telling stories about violence based in Mount Druitt. But, you know, it's for me as a writer, as a literary critic, I read them as fiction. And I think there is a tendency to read stories by people of color and sort of like other marginalized groups to read their fiction as autobiography or as very thinly veiled autobiography, whereas we afford the luxury of imagination and invention and creation to more dominant groups, white men specifically, to sort of see their fiction, as purely the product of an amazing mind that's wandered around and, you know, astrally projected and all that. Like, whereas for people of color, our stories can only come from our bodies, our lived experience that we can't imagine, you know? And so, like, I just want to, like, and I'm not saying that you've said this, I just think for 1/4, I think it's more productive to think of their storytelling, their sort of, the stories that they tell as, think of it as fiction, as what, as an image that they are deliberately, intentionally putting out and crafting. And like, you know, what does it mean to create this idea of like a dangerous, lawless Mount Druitt? Like, what does that mean? You know, like, why are they doing that? Instead of thinking that, instead of taking it literally at face value, like, and so as far as violence goes, I think that 1/4 are very deliberately using it to create an image of Western Sydney that is both romantic, but also like repulsive to gentrifiers and gentrifier wannabes, you know, and people that actually take advantage of, like, actual gentrifiers who take advantage of these sort of like neglected areas and being like, no, stay out. We don't want you here. This is going to be dangerous for you. And as far as like talking about the violences that we don't see, you know, like the violences of gentrification, you know, because there's this idea that like, oh, all these areas that are about to be gentrified, they're unsafe, you know, they're dangerous. But then once they are gentrified, once more privileged demographics start taking over, they become dangerous for the original inhabitants of the original populations of that suburb or area. Like, and so it's a question not only of the violences, the violence that people of color sort of like very deliberately exaggerate, but also the violences of gentrification of sort of like hegemonic populations, like how that's invisibilized, romanticized, and even been like, it's kind of like, it's actually good. And it's not even thought of as violence. It's just something else completely. It's crocheting shit and putting on telegraph poles and being like, this is culture. It's like, no, culture was here. Culture has been here for like so long.
So like, there's a vested interest in taking away the artistic label, taking away the artistic merit of these pieces of work, because then you can just make them a reality. And reality has to be dealt with, you know? That's what I think is, you know, the police are hanging a hat on. Violent lyrics are a reflection. You're confessing to a crime here. You're not reflecting art.
Yeah. On that note of violence, you know, I want to say, like, we can't talk about violence without talking about the first ever violence that was inflicted on this country, which was to the Indigenous people of this land. You know, sovereignty was never ceded. And so Australia continues its colonization and its violence, like why Australia continues its colonization and its violence every single day. And because of that, of course, people of color are angry. We have to understand that in a society that kind of bell hooks calls white supremacist, imperialist, capitalist patriarchy, anybody who's marginalized would be angry at that structure. Mm. And so the kind of artistic representation of violence that we see kind of dotted here and there in this little red thing, and the artistic interpretation of violence as we see in 1/4's lyrics, are simply a kind of representation of a wound that marginalized people have, you know, a wound from kind of colonization, imperialism, patriarchy, white supremacy that makes us demonized. You know, 1/4 have gone through those lived experiences and they just want to talk about it. You know, they've gone on record to say they just want to talk about what they've gone through, but that they're not advocating for it. They're not advocating for violence to take place. And like you said, violence hasn't taken place in their concerts. But, you know, you can compare it to like a kind of rap group like Hilltop Hoods, where a lot of their listeners are kind of very macho white guys who carry around the Australian flag, which is a symbol of violence. And any person of color seeing a kind of group of white men carrying around the Australian flag, you know, knows that something's going wrong. You know, that's kind of reminiscent of what happened at the Cronulla riots, where these white men were holding up Australian flags and saying no more libs, you know. And that violence is just seen as kind of this larrikin, that Australia, this kind of myth of the larrikin that Australian, that white Australia has made up to kind of cover its violence. But when white people are very genuinely angry and frustrated and want to show that in their writing, want to show that in their lyrics, want to show that in their art. Again, like Stephen said, it's deemed as kind of face value, like you're confessing to a crime and we'll stop you. We'll demonize you and make you the violence that's in Australia, rather than white Australia reflecting on itself and being like, hey, how will we violent? What have we done to kind of make this culture?
I think there might be something else at issue here, and I see the can of worms, and I don't want to open the can of worms, but I'm going to open the can of worms here because I think there is also I often come back to an issue of readership, and it can be quite controversial to tell anyone how to read, but I think it's a failing when we tend to read in a single way. And what we're also dealing with is a readership response here, and often a dominant culture readership response to issues that they don't understand, they don't like, they feel threatened by is anger and discomfort. And when that is then rationalized, the anger and the discomfort has to become action against the thing that has angered them. And so we see these sort of dominant culture responses, and I think that's a failure of readership. And I think conversations like this where we are able to actually delve into the art of a piece of work have an opportunity to at least show someone a different way to read, a different way to approach something.
Yeah. You know, Ruby Hamad recently published a book called White Tears, Brown Scars, where she talks about the demonizing metaphor of kind of the angry brown woman or the angry black woman. And she says that it's kind of more racist to tell somebody that they're racist than the actual racism itself that was enacted upon a person of color.
Don't tell a white person they're white.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And so when people like me or Stephen confront racism in our writing, confront racism in person kind of every day, and we get the response of, oh, I didn't mean it like that, was it? And then it just becomes about their feelings and about how they wanted to interpret their own words rather than a self-reflection of, you know, oh, hey, like maybe I did say something really demonizing and really controversial and I should reflect on that, you know. And the kind of white tears aspect in Ruby Hamad's book is that white women often use their tears to make a situation about racism that could potentially be resolved just about their feelings. And then it creates a kind of damsel narrative where suddenly everybody's flocking to start protecting the feelings of that white person. And then the brown woman or the black woman or the Arab guy or the Asian guy who was trying to confront that racism and resolve it is now being seen as the perpetrator. And so definitely when we read stuff like This Little Red Thing, when we read stuff like Ruby's book, like Michael Muhammad Ahmed's book, it is about readership. It is about white people confronting their whiteness, just as people of color have to confront their culture and their coloredness. I say that in quotes all the time. And the readership has to change to allow that self-reflection.
I think this might be a really good point as we nod to the readers to reintroduce the book. We are discussing This Little Red Thing. I've immediately grabbed my copy. It's a beautiful book and you cannot miss it. Very slim, very red, and
it's 5,000 words long, and it's going to make a great Christmas present. I was going to say it's like $15.
Very inexpensive. It's
sweatshop.ws.
It's
you know?
It's a perfect non-denominational festive sock stuffer.
Absolutely, or end of year gifts. I do end of year gifts.
End of year gifts. Yeah,
absolutely. I just think that's smart. Like, that everybody should jump on the website. www.sweatshop.ws, see our books, buy This Little Red Thing. And yeah, I think it's really cost affordable.
This Little Red Thing, I'm speaking with Winnie Dunn. I'm also speaking with Stephen Pham. They're both from Sweatshop who have produced This Little Red Thing. Thank you so much both for coming into the studio.
Thanks for speaking to us.
Malo.
That's it for this great conversation with Winnie Dunn and Stephen Pham about This Little Red Thing. This Little Red Thing is available now through Sweatshop, and you can go to sweatshop.ws/this-little-red-thing. Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. To keep up with the latest in books, writing and literary culture, follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. We're at the handle at FinalDraft2SER. And if you subscribe in your podcast app, it means a great new Great Conversation every week. My name is Andrew Popel. There's still plenty more reads before the end of the year, so tune in next week where I'm going to have more great conversations from Final Draft. Till then, happy reading.